both from the subcommittee of the subcommittee of the Joint Ways and Means Committee on the hearing on public hearing portion of Senate Bill 5514. And I believe that we were with Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of the Department of Revenue, and Jim Brown, Deputy Director of the Department of Revenue. And let's just go ahead and get started. And if there are any questions, please hold the questions, folks, for some period of time. Thank you very much.
Thank
you. Corrupt it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee and staff. Elizabeth Harchenko, Director. Yesterday we were going through our overview presentation, and Jim had just gotten to the point where he was going to talk with you about our productivity gains.
See how fast we can go through it, Jim. We can probably cover two or three sections here.
Well, if we'll turn to page 80, which is the last page of the book.
That's the only one I had questions on.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jim Brown, the Deputy Director of the Department of Revenue. Actually, we'll start on page 24. And if you'll recall, up to that point, we talked to you about how our workload had been increasing over the last 10 to 12 years, and we had a fairly flat total number of employees. And we talked about the mixture of our employees within that, where we had significantly fewer managers and fewer clerical employees, more professional, technical, and more computer-related. So with that in mind, we'll sort of talk you through some of the things we've done to be able to get to that point of being able to kind of increase workload with the same staff. And a number of those things are detailed on pages 24 and 25. Starting out, recall that we said we had eliminated a layer of managers in the department and reduced the managers from around 151 to 71. So we made a very significant reduction there. As part of that, we moved to an environment where we do a lot more of our problem-solving in teams by employees that are on the front lines actually interacting with taxpayers, and they're more empowered now to deal with and solve problems. We organized, I believe, in 1996. I think Elizabeth alluded to the fact that we'd organized differently to better serve the taxpayers. The main change is going from a division that had an audit function and another division had a collection function to two divisions that are based on either personal taxpayers or business taxpayers. One of the examples of the advantage of that is where we do filing enforcement work, where we locate people that haven't filed returns that should have filed and bring them into the system before the audit division would locate the non-filer, set up an assessment, and then pass it on to the collection division, who then have to subsequently try and collect the amount of money that was due. And the communication wasn't as good as it could be between those two groups. And by having the organization along the personal taxpayer lines, we have now people within the same units working with the taxpayer from the time they're identified as a non-filer through filing the return, through payment of the tax, and having them into the system.
So if you'd buy the same person that would be holding your hand in effect?
It's not necessarily, Mr. Chair, it's not necessarily the same person, but it's within the same work unit.
Okay.
So it'd be people, if I had a question about how the assessment was set up, I'd go to my neighbor next door and say, when you worked on this, rather than somebody two or three floors away that I've never met, and they have much better communication, and they work, they get to the collecting of the account much quicker. So there's just much better communication. Then we've listed a number of things we've done to streamline, automate processes and systems. And there's really two results from these efforts. A number of these things we've done has helped make it much easier for taxpayers to meet their requirements or comply with the law. And a number of them have made it more efficient for the department to process things. And a good number have done both. And I'll explain those as we get through them. This is in a chronological order over about the last 7 years. In 1993, we completed building what we call our integrated tax accounting system. Prior to that time, we had as many as five different accounting systems for different programs. So if you owed money in timber and you also owed money in personal income tax, you might get telephone calls from two different agents, one working your timber account, one working your income tax account, and they wouldn't know that we have more than one account. Now with a single integrated accounting system, we can companion all those accounts for an individual, get them to an agent, and they can work with the taxpayer to clear up all their liabilities with that one phone call.
So it's really consolidation by the federal ID or state ID numbers then?
Yes, it is. We generally use Social Security number as our identifier in the personal income tax.
I noticed the other day, and I don't know how much we were supposed to notice in the way of actual confidential information. I don't think I actually, without getting down and getting my back working, it wouldn't work for me anyway, but I noticed that they were working on an issue dealing with an organ filing number on a corporate tax return, and they were trying to sort that out in your part of your problems resolution area. What I have often wondered, as a practical matter, I've never used the organ filing number. They used to send them out with the pre-prepared labels, and now they're going to even do that. What is the organ filing number? Because I noticed that they were trying to grind through to find, you know, when that return had last been filed under that particular number, and why wouldn't the FEIN be just the federal employer identification number?
Okay. I would miss the
very good.
We have to support the Cancer Society.
Mr. Chair, your hands have just been slapped.
Mr. Chair, we will get the answer to that question unless Jim saw it off the top of his head.
Okay.
How we deal with incorporated taxpayers, for individual taxpayers who do use Social Security numbers.
Exactly.
For incorporated, we'll check that out. I was under the impression you used the federal number.
And it still calls for a corporate filing number, and up until about 10 years ago, that corporate filing number was printed on the pre-prepared sticky mail folder that you have. Then they stopped doing that, and I don't know what it's for. And I noticed they were spending a rather considerable amount of time in trying to get those numbers to mesh. And I don't understand why you would need multiple numbers other than perhaps under the integrated tax accounting system, and maybe but if that's the case, then everyone with a Schedule C that has something on the labor line should also have to have a taxpayer identification number for filing purposes as well. So I guess I'm having trouble grasping what that number is even used for, if it's something we could, maybe consolidate away from.
Mr. Chair, we'll get the answer as to what it is we're using to identify taxpayer accounts and have that for you now.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
The second bullet under streamlining is we now utilize data from the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, IRS, that was my first quarter. We use data from the Internal Revenue Service on employers, so that employers no longer have to file their W-2s with the state of Oregon as well as with the federal government. We began that in about 1993. In 1993, we also started for the first time filing with personal income tax returns electronically. Later in the report, when we get into the details of the personal income tax program, you'll see the rapid growth. So we've actually gone from our first returns in 93 to over 150,000 electronically filed returns this year. Another area where we have utilized data from the Internal Revenue Service is on the details from the federal schedules. It used to be we would ask for the entire copy of the federal tax return, and ask that be submitted with the Oregon return. Now we only ask for the Form 1040. That, again, makes it easier for taxpayers and much easier for us, both to store and sort through the returns. We have implemented a scannable tax payment coupon. You saw the high-speed mail opening or remittance processing equipment. That scannable coupon goes through that equipment along with the check and helps identify where the payments should go. We created an automated collection system. I gave you the example yesterday of somebody that was working with a taxpayer who wanted to enter into a payment agreement on the telephone, and they used to have to get off the phone, dictate a letter, dictate some coupons that would go to an office service center who would create all that and mail it out. And now they essentially enter the payment agreement on the computer, and it automatically creates all that information. That's only one of a very significant number of features that help our revenue agents in their productivity. And in a couple pages, I'll get to a chart that shows how that productivity has increased, and I'll refer you back to that when I do. We have provided taxpayer access to tax forms and other kinds of information via the Internet. And when we get into the, again, a little later this afternoon, when we get into the personal income tax and the income tax program portion of the report, you'll see the rapid growth in the use of the Internet. One simple example there is that I had a gentleman call me from Germany about a year and a half ago and wanted to know what he would have to do to get a copy of the tax form for Oregon because he had gone into the military and he needed to file his return, and he was concerned about what he would need to do. In prior years, what we would do is we'd take the name and address, we would send it down to the mail room where you saw that operation with the first name on your tour. They would pull the forms for the taxpayer, they would put them in the mail and send them out, and in maybe a week or two in Germany he'd have the forms and ready to start filing. I told him about our website. You can download the forms and the instructions. He called me back about a half hour later and was just thrilled with that service. He said it was just incredible. It was so easy to use, and he just got on there, found where the forms were, located the ones he needed, and pressed a button, and he had them printed out on his printer. In the property tax area, you saw some of the cartography. We've had a large flatbed scanner where we now can scan some of that mapping data into that digital system rather than hand ink mapping changes. We introduced in 1996 electronic data transfer on some of the agencies that we collect debt for, in our other agency account program, which we will talk to you about probably tomorrow in the presentation. We have provided some online access to timber return history, where now if a taxpayer calls in with questions on their timber tax, they can usually respond to their question right on the spot rather than have to call them back.
That looks like that's one of your most difficult or most spendy taxes to oversee is the timber tax.
That's exactly the relationship to the dollars. When we get to the probably tomorrow in the presentation, we talk about some of our other tax programs. We'll give you some additional data about some of the reasons behind why some are more expensive to administer than others. One of the services that's used by just a lot of taxpayers is we now have, through our interactive voice response system, we have the ability to, you can call on that phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and with some information, you can access the status of your refund. So if you filed on March 29th and you haven't received your refund yet and you wanted to know what was going on, you could call that number, and through that interactive voice response system, you could enter your Social Security number, and I think you have to also enter your refund amount, a security check, and it'll tell you where that return is in processing. We installed high-speed remittance processing equipment that you saw on the deposits. That was done in 1997. You saw, Nancy gave you some of the explanation of how our ability to get the money in the bank much more rapidly has been improved by that system. We built an automated system to create timber value tables. One of the things that makes the timber program more expensive is we have to calculate numerous value tables for different grade and species of timber, because the tax is based on that, on those value tables, and we created an automated system to do that. You saw on the tour where we were working to digitize maps. That started in 1998 and is an ongoing project, and will still take a number of years to complete that project.
And I had a question with regard to the digitalization of the maps. The global information systems that the Department of Administrative Services has, how integrated are we with the rather substantial amount of global information service information that they have?
Mr. Chair, we're just scratching the surface. At this point, we're working on the property tax map. And as you saw on the tour, the potential for the overlay, and we're starting to do that work in those two or three counties where we're converting the maps to digital. Our plan is that if 2139 makes it through the process as it is currently constructed, there will be some additional funds for a statewide mapping system, and we expect to be collaborating with Information Resources Management Division.
It's Hospital 2139.
2139, that's right. That's euphemistically known as the Assessment and Taxation Funding Bill. There's a dollar of that fee that's being continued that's going to be dedicated to mapping. And so we will be definitely collaborating with Information Resources Management Division to see how we can leverage what we've got and what they've got in their Geographical Information Systems Group to help the idea of a statewide digitally based mapping system come alive.
Dr. Schenkel, 2139 doesn't make it through the House and doesn't make it through the Senate, doesn't make it past the governor's desk, I'm toast. So no reason for me to go home to my county.
Moving on, the next thing is we created an automated examination system for our corporation tax auditors. That, again, allows them to electronically record most of their work papers, most of the records that they keep during the course of an audit, and actually their write-up of their reports is done online. We've implemented electronic fund transfer for large payroll payments. I think on the tour, Nancy showed you the, it's pretty boring. It's just like a small PC that you look at, but that's where some of the payments are coming in through that electronic process. And again, when we get into the more details of the withholding program, probably either late today or tomorrow, I believe John Scott will give you a little bit of information about that program and sort of the growth in that program. We are now in the process of building new automated timber and senior deferral systems that will interface with our integrated tax accounting system. Those are some of the last programs that we are converting to bring over, along with a few of the other smaller programs that we administer. Actually, senior deferral should be up within the month, and timber is scheduled to come up in about September or October. All of our systems, our integrated tax accounting system, and all of these other systems that are being merged in with that system are year 2000 compliant. And so we've been reviewed by the ProBX, which is a company that the Department of Administrative Services has hired to do audits. And we have, I believe, 5 statewide mission critical systems that are all green status. So we're in really good shape there. In a large part due to having really some staff in the mid-80s, some technical staff before managers, you were even aware of this problem, that were smart enough to recognize that as they created new systems, they needed to solve the problem. So we're very fortunate to have some exceptional staff in our computer area that basically fixed the problem before a lot of us knew what year 2000 computer glitch was. We're also building some new automated systems for doing industrial property returns. That's a document that the major corporations with properties in excess of $1 million that we value, it's some information that they send us to help facilitate that value. If you're like me, it's nice to say, gee, those are really some great things you've done, and you talked about increased productivity, but show me the money. And I think the next couple of slides are designed to show you some of the results of what we've done. The top chart on this one is actually the documents processed each year. You see we process over 4 million documents. The dip between 90, 91, and 92, 93 is one of the rarities where a program that we administer was actually eliminated by the legislature. Representative Butler, I'm sure you'll remember the HARP program, the Homeowner and Rental Property Tax Relief Program. That went away after the 91 session, and that's why the slight dip in the number of documents there. But if you look at the next document down, you'll see the next chart, even though the number of documents continues to grow at a fairly significant rate, the hours that it takes to process those has diminished, and then the last couple of years leveled off. A couple of things that happened in that 92, 93, to 94, 95 that really helped cut those down were the implementation of elimination of federal schedules and the scannable tax payment coupon. those two things really help drive our processing hours needed to process those documents down dramatically. The next page is one that I think a lot of us are particularly proud of. It talks about the productivity gains in personal income tax collection. It shows in the top the average dollars collected per full-time equivalent employee per month, and the bottom is the actual average accounts closed per full-time equivalent employee per month. And again, if you look about that 95, 96 year, which is somewhere close to the middle of each of those charts, that is when we introduced the automated collection system. So you can see that since that introduction of the automated collection system, we've gone from about $57,000 a month per agent to almost $75,000 per month per agent. And we've gone from closing just over 80 accounts to almost 105 accounts a month. Those tools have made them significantly more productive. The next page talks to you about some things we plan to do in the future. You've always got lots of things on the burner, and we've got lots of things that we're thinking about doing. I think it's important to point out that in the policy package in the governor's recommended budget, there are 12 additional information systems professionals in that package. And these are some of the kind of things that we plan on doing with the level of resource that would provide should you approve it. Again, we're going to implement, should you approve that package, a telefile for the simpler personal income tax returns so that people can actually file by touchtone telephone. That's a project that the Internal Revenue Service has had going for several years and has been quite successful for them. We see that really both as an ease for taxpayers and a compliance tool where you get a lot of young people that are just filing those easier returns, and you get them filing and get them in the habit of filing with the technology they're comfortable with. We think they're more likely to be compliant filing taxpayers on into the future. So it's a tool that we think will do both of those for us. We plan on continuing to expand electronic filing, both through the internet with a personal computer and through carriers with the Internal Revenue Service. We're going to expand access to the department by providing year-round toll-free lines. Right now, we only provide a toll-free lines between January and April. Kind of this package would include funding to add two toll-free lines in that peak time and then to also provide for toll-free lines for the rest of the year. We're finding with things like kicker checks and other things that our business, even though we still have a big peak in January through April, that there's a significant amount of business people are doing with the state and with us throughout the year, and we think it's important to provide those toll-free lines. We plan to provide online registration and return filing for business taxes. So if you're going to start a new business, we're going to work and see if we can put together an online registration system. We're going to expand electronic fund transfer. John Scott, again, later today, will talk to you about that. We'll talk to you about bringing on business corporate taxes and then expanding the number of employers and corporations that will be paying us electronically. We want to find ways to exploit imaging technology. You can tell from our tool, again, that we still have a lot of paper that we process, and we're looking at ways to streamline that paper-intensive process. We want to rewrite our database system that we use to develop the utility value rules. Probably tomorrow when Randy Evers talks to you about utility appraisal, he'll explain that a little bit further. We want to test the feasibility of electronic filing for industrial property returns. Again, that's those over $1 million industrial sites in Oregon that we value. We want to develop a statewide land information system. Again, that's within the House Bill 2139 funding. And we want to rewrite a machinery equipment database system, which is something our appraisers use to look up values of equipment as they're doing those industrial appraisals. Switch to page 29 and then 30. Actually, now we're going to change gears on here and talk to you about sort of the history of our budget. The first slide on page 30 shows you our operating budget. Now, within our budget bill, there is also an appropriation for elderly rental assistance payments, It's a general fund appropriation. So when you look at Mr. Dunford numbers and compare them to these, this is our operating budget, which is the amount without that elderly rental assistance appropriation. You can see, again, it's been fairly flat. The increase between 89-91 and 91-93 was really due to a couple of things. We got some additional positions due to Measure 5 and the complexities that that brought to the system. And I believe there were 11 positions there, and then we also got about 8 positions to increase revenue collections. It was one of the first times that the legislature had seen fit to try and balance the budget by having us collect some of that money that's otherwise not paid. So you can see the sort of the growth in that budget over that time period. The next page really gives you just the numerical on page 31, the numerical comparison between the 97-99 legislatively approved budget and the 99-01 governor's recommended budget. I do need to make clear here that we put together this chart before the governor did his rebalanced budget. So there are, in the governor's rebalanced budget, there's an additional 13 positions, and the cost of those are not included in this column. It's the 99-01 governor's budget column. The main differences you can see on this chart, our general fund operating budget is up about $8.6 million. That's a little over a 10% increase. And I'll give you details on the next page that explains everything that makes up that change. The other funds are down $1.2 million. Again, that's primarily because the 14.5 FTE from the assessor funding bill 2139 are not in this budget. Those will come along if that, assuming Representative Butler's correct and that moves through the system, then we will get those 14.5 FTEs either through the emergency board or through the process as that bill moves through. But this reduction is primarily due to the fact that those are not in the budget for the second year of R&M. The $624,000 reduction in elderly rental assistance is elderly rental assistance is a program that gives relief to extremely low-income elderly renters. They have to have $10,000 of income or less, and they have to pay more than 20% of that income in rent. And the amount isn't indexed and is not changing. So as inflation provides people with more income, people fall off the program every year, and that's why the cost is predicted for next finding to be $624,000 than last finding.
Are there any bills outstanding on that?
In the elderly rental assistance, I don't believe so. Susan?
Okay. There are some other bills related to, as we talked yesterday, other assistance for property tax relief. But
yes, in the senior deferral program, there are bills that we talked about yesterday that would add people to that. The next page, page 32, just gives you a breakdown of that $8.6 million increase in general fund and the $1.2 million reduction in other funds. Just to hit the highlights of the large ones, the first item, the $2.4 million, is actually the cost of position actions that occurred during this timing. So, for example, management service got a 2% cost of living increase February 1 of this binding, so it's only in the budget. Current budget for 4 months, and it will be in next finance budget for 2024. Those kinds of costs that roll up represent the $2.4 million, and those are probably things you're used to seeing in every budget that comes before you. The next one is the estimated cost of the 1999-01 MERIT increases, and again, that's probably the kind of thing you see in most budgets. Removal of the kicker costs, I want to point out. $782,757 is the other fund amount that we spent last biennium to issue kicker checks. And again, if we're in that mode and the revenues hold as they look like they will, then we'll be back to see you probably in the emergency board and to get other fund limitation authority. The Attorney General fund cost is a reduction that we believe we could make because the number of appeals to the magistrate division on complex cases are less than we anticipated, and we're settling more cases. And actually, in addition to that amount, I talked to your staff about another $500,000 that we believe can actually come out of that amount. And so I'm sure Sue will be talking to you about that once she does her report. The inflation is the typical cost of living increase given to us by the Department of Administrative Services, along with some specific line item adjustments. The phasing of electronic fund transfer, we got some positions partway through the biennium for that electronic fund transfer. The appeals section went away partway through last biennium, and they'll be gone this biennium, so that's out of there. The assessor funding sunset on the other fund column, the 1.6, is the one we've talked about several times already today and is in the House bill that hopefully is moving. And the other big one at the bottom is the tax compliance policy package that was included in the governor's recommended budget. This one actually generates about $8.1 million in revenue for that $4.1 million cost. And we will get into the details of that policy package with you when we get into the toward the end of the personal income tax discussion.
Which package is that specifically? I think I've got four tax compliance packages.
It may be the roll-up of all four in this
report,
but each of the packages is probably the positions and the other costs per division.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And the next just gives you the change in the FTE that was shown on page 31, actually 72.72 FTE up, and it gives you the breakdown of the different things that caused that FTE to switch. The big ones again are 39.5 FTE in the compliance policy package and the 14.5 that phased out with assessor funding. With that, I just want to point out the major issues in our budget. I believe Elizabeth's going to.
That's right. We've mentioned both of them. You're becoming familiar with both of them. We have a compliance package that has four parts. As Jim mentioned, it's broken down by what division of the different pieces we go into, as well as the other fund issue related to the staff that we have that's paid for out of what's known in the building as assessor funding, and that is House Bill 2139. At this point, that has passed the House. And I believe that after it goes through the Senate Revenue Committee, it does have a subsequent appropriation meeting. We plan to talk, Mr. Chair, about the compliance package in more detail during our presentation on the income tax, which is the next tab in the book, if that's acceptable to you. I will call up Susan Browning and John Scott.
I will pay my fine for my IRS Internal Revenue Service. And I, as I said yesterday, after 28 years, I don't know what to do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to reintroduce to you Susan Browning, who is the administrator of our Personal Tax and Compliance Division, and John Scott, who is the administrator of our Business Division. And I think Susan will begin. Our theme for the presentation on income taxes is about what we call a balanced approach to healthy income tax systems. And if you'll turn to page 36, we begin by trying to show you visually here a profile of taxpayer compliance in our income tax system. As you can see, the red portion of that pie is the almost 89% of taxpayers are trying hard to file on time, file correctly, pay on time, and we want to do everything we can to support that because as the population of the state grows, the numbers of people in absolute numbers who need to be in that category also continues to grow. And much of the information we're going to give you today and the theme of most of our policy package is to try to maintain an appropriate level of investment in supporting those taxpayers so that it's as easy as possible for them to do what they were supposed to do and do it timely and correctly. The income tax systems, both the personal income tax and our business taxes, pretty much depend upon voluntary compliance by taxpayers. And they do a lot of the work to calculate their liability and get the payments in to us, and then we keep track of their doing that well. So I'd like to turn it over to Susan.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Browning with the Oregon Department of Revenue. As Elizabeth pointed out on page 36, really if you look at where the dollars come from, this red, red, blue, and green pie chart is according to the number of dollars coming in. Almost 90% of the dollars come in from people who voluntarily comply and pay. And that's what we really want to support and encourage is that type of activity. So we would do that with education and assistance. As you see, there's about 9% of the dollars are not found by the Department of Revenue, and we find probably about 2% and work with those taxpayers to get them into compliance when you look at the total dollars. When you turn to page 37, you see a breakdown of actually how we get the money into the system. As you can see, we really need to continue to support those who are trying to comply. 72% of the dollars come in through withholding. That's a very effective way of gathering the tax dollars in. Almost 26% comes in from those who pay with the return when they file. And then the remaining 2.5% is where the Department of Revenue becomes involved in the auditing and collections. You can see a good part of that comes in through 1.3% comes in from pay plans. And that's what we really try to encourage with them, with taxpayers as well. If they possibly can, to set up a pay plan and just make installment payments to pay off their debt. And that works very well for most people.
Those are new automated, easy-to-do pay plans, the easy pay-as-you-go plan.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. With the new systems we have, it's very easy to do. And the taxpayers actually get little payment coupons that they can reach months so they can send it in, just as you would with your PGE bill or any other kind of bill, to remind you to pay that. Many people, like 0.85% of it comes in through billing letters. Many people will comply very quickly if you send out a letter and they respond. They didn't realize they owed that debt or bought it was a misunderstanding, so they pay in response to the billing letter. The other 0.35% is where we spend a lot of our activity in the filing enforcement program to get compliance from people who do not wish to comply with our state tax laws. So that really emphasizes the necessity of supporting and helping work with those who want to comply and make it easy for them and understandable for them to do that. So that's how the big picture of how we get the income tax dollars. With that, I wanted to turn it over to John, and he's going to talk with you a little bit about how the business program interacts.
And I'm going to speak primarily to the 72% that comes in through the withholding and payroll programs. The withholding program is basically a combined payroll program that employers pay to the department, and we hold those funds in trust, and employees file the following year, and they will either get a refund or they will pay the additional payment if it's not sufficient. The payroll tax is are taxes that employers pay for unemployment and workers' comp, as well as if they are in the counties of Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington, or TriMet. They pay the transit tax and the lane transit tax as well. The withholding tax, as you can see, we generate roughly $3.7 billion banks in 1998 for the combined payroll tax program. On any large banking day, we bank up to $60 to $70 million in payroll or combined taxes. Businesses register, on a number of 12 to 1,500 new businesses register each month, and that same number close each month. These are not necessarily the same businesses, but different businesses. During good economic times, as we've been experiencing here lately, we have a tendency to have more businesses register than close.
Can I ask a question relative to the withholding? And it's really a foolish question, but I really, really want to know. Are estimated tax payments considered to be withholding in this overall scheme of things, the 72% withholding that you've got there? Estimated tax payments, corporate
income. Mr. Chair, the way that we developed that chart what withholding is what's coming in actually through employers, true withholding.
True withholding.
And that the green part of that pie is estimated payments as well as payments that come in with the final, the annual return.
And that would be corporate estimates as well as individual.
Correct. That's right.
Yeah. Now, I have another question that's only distantly related to that, and that is the you take into consideration the withholding, the amount that's withheld from the TriMap and Lane County as well. Is that part of our 72% withholding? Jim shaking his head no.
No.
I think when we put this together, we were trying to focus on
our income.
Right, exactly.
And John is, as John talked about this, and he talked about payroll taxes, part of the reason is that they are the payroll taxes for both the Lane Transit District and TriMet piggyback very nicely onto withholding. The tax base is identical. And so if you go through that process, they come in together. But when we're talking about withholding of income tax dollars, we are limiting ourselves to the personal income tax.
And finally, relative to the Lane County and TriMet, they're not reflected here anywhere on page 37. What's our most recent intergovernmental agreement with those agencies, do you know?
Mr. Chair, are you asking how recently have we renewed an agreement?
How recently have we renewed our agreement?
I don't have that off the top of my head. I'll get the information for you.
I'm wondering if we might obtain copies of the current IGA.
All right. Let me get those for you.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to distract. Those are just questions around the community.
You'll also note that we have, at any given time, 100,000 businesses that currently are registered with the department. One of our taxpayer service units takes about, on any given day, anywhere from 6,000 calls that provide those businesses with services to help clarify their needs and provide them with services where to go and how to do that. We were the first state back in 1990 to implement the single registration, which means that on a single form, businesses are able to register and file their withholding, their unemployment workers' compensation fees, as well as the transit fees if they're in the TriMet or Lane counties. And they do it all on one form. And they also pay that also on one form. So to the best of my knowledge, we are one of a few states that do that as a service for businesses. Want to draw your attention to the business education and compliance. In November of 1997, we launched a project to see if we provided the businesses with more taxpayer education and assistance up front. Would that begin to make a difference in terms of voluntary compliance? We contacted roughly 15 to 2,000 businesses. We had a couple of agents that went out in the field, went around the state, talked with contractors on site, as well as did the workshops, small business fairs. Of that, we were able to identify 151 of those businesses that were not withholding their organ taxes for their employees and not paying the payroll taxes. And so we were able to then bring into voluntary compliance 140 of those, or roughly 93%. We continue to work with the 11 that are not in compliance in a variety of ways, up to and including a payment plan. I'd like to maybe share a story, and you may wonder, well, how these particular businesses are able to do business in the state of Oregon without being registered for payroll and withholding. A number of these are from out of state, Washington, Idaho, Utah, and some of them are contractors, and they contract for large projects to in and out in very short periods of time. And so, and a lot of the general contractors in the state may or may not be aware that they're either registered or not. And so we have managed to go out and visit each one of those sites, work with the general contractors and the subs, and that's how we've been able to get compliance from the out-of-state contracts. We've also extended our partnership with the contractor boards for Washington State, Idaho, and Utah, and they're putting our information in the information that the subcontractors and general contractors get as they come into the state.
You then work with the Construction Contractors Board for the State of Oregon.
Absolutely.
To compare information. Do they use the federal employee ID number anywhere on the license itself so that you can cross-match licenses?
No, but I'll find out.
Okay. Would that perhaps assist in the search that you do to determine whether or not we're compliant with other states when we handle those? In other words, if folks are going to have a liquor license in the state of Oregon, if folks are going to have a contractor's license in the state of Oregon, if they're going to have these other kinds of things, would that be appropriate to go ahead and have that number listed, the Social Security or federal ID number, so that we'd be able to find those that are falling out of the system because perhaps they're reporting to another state all of their income and not any to Oregon, thinking that maybe they can just go ahead and pay to the state of Utah or the state of Idaho?
That's a really intriguing suggestion, and we'll see if we can't follow up with some of the other agencies. We do try very hard to partner and with the Employment Department and the Department of Consumer and Business Services, for whom we collect today. We obviously have a way to keep our account tracking systems working together. But this idea of having other licensing boards or other organizations that we work with also get federal ID numbers or whatever it is that we would be able to use to have a common database would be very
good. We don't want to over-collect, we just want to collect.
Representative,
what the contract is for, that's currently done when you register with the contractors for to get your... Well, not licensed, just be registered. You have to provide all your tax information.
Including your Social Security number, your corporate business number.
And you have to show, I believe, and I haven't done it for a long time, but you have to show proof that you've got account set up. And
we're being recorded here, so.
Yeah.
You know, in all seriousness, we're just trying to find to make sure that there is a easier way to make sure that everyone is paying the tax to the state of Oregon. I think from Portland you're basically in a two-state community, and it's probably more critical in Portland because you've got a non-income tax state adjacent to you. And I know that in Idaho, with an 8% marginal bracket, the upper bracket, as opposed to Oregon's 9% bracket, that there are many people who have licenses to do hair salons and those kinds of things that try and just report it all to Idaho. So anyway, I just would make sure that the boards of cosmetology and hairdressers and those folks, we just go ahead and make it as easy on ourselves as possible can. I'm sorry for that.
The only other thing I wanted to mention is that this work, working with the contractors, doing a lot of the proactive service, registering employers on site, is work that we hadn't done before. As we do that, as we begin to have more and more success, as has been identified by roughly our efforts generate 93% of voluntary compliance, and then the ability to enhance our monthly workshops, not only in Portland but around the state, this is part of our policy package, and that's what one or two of those agents would be. So unless there are other questions, I will turn it over to Susan, and she will talk about other ways that we have passed here.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. Are there any questions for Mr. Scott at this time? Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I mentioned, voluntary compliance is very, very important to the department and to the health of the tax system, income tax system. And we try to help taxpayers in a variety of methods. So depending on what their preferences are and how they work best, we can meet that need. Through paper media, we send out approximately 936,000 income tax booklets. We publish 61 information circulars. And then we also work with the high schools and have developed a publication, Understanding Oregon Taxes, so that 800 high school teachers can present information to those who are just starting to enter the workforce and get them on the path of good practice there as far as paying.
Sure. Senator Crowe,
is that possible for us to see a copy of that?
Would you be delighted to, Senator Crowe? Yes. That's really an effective method if we can get beginning taxpayers and get them on the road to filing and paying. I think that's an effective way to keep them in the system long term.
I just wanted to tell you a quick story. We have a program within the department that we call Leadership Revenue, where we pull together a group of people each year to develop their leadership skills. One of the teams in that group this year decided that they wanted to do something about taxpayer education. So they put an education presentation together and went out to a number of high schools in the state and actually presented a class, a 50-minute program, to, I believe it was juniors. And the staff reported back that when they first went into the room and said who they were and where they were from, they got the reaction that you would expect. People sort of closed up and, what are you doing here? And, you know, bad expressions, frowns, and grimaces about taxes. When they finished explaining why we pay taxes and how income taxes support the public schools and how income taxes support providing adequate correctional facilities and health care and all the things that income taxes pay for, the students' attitude changed. Then they went through the process of helping them to just work through the form so that as these young people start out into the workforce, whether it's flipping hamburgers for their first job or doing retail or whatever, they have an appreciation for why they pay taxes, that this isn't just a burden that's imposed on them for which they get no return. And they were just really excited when they came back and talked to us about the response that they got from young people about this program. So this was just, that was just one little project that group did, but it really had, I think, it really is an investment now in those people wanting to comply and get into the system.
Sure, we need to do more of that. I think people do not understand the importance of paying taxes in the society. Who was it that said that paying taxes is part of living in a civilization obligation?
All the rental homes would say something like that.
Yeah.
Better record that down somewhere. I didn't realize this. Of course, the home society wasn't all that civilized either, Senator Trella. Yeah.
The home society.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for those who prefer to use electronic means, we have a very active and updated website. I'll share some examples of the information that's available on the website. I think Jim mentioned that briefly before, to help people file and gain information. And in 1999, we expect to have about 230,000 taxpayers actually go in and use the website. So, it's been interesting as we've been dealing with the federal retirees. It's amazing how responsive and how interested they've been using the website. So it's been a real effective way of communicating with them and keeping them up to date because they really want to know what's progressing. That's an easy way to contact all of them out there. So it's been pretty effective.
Susan, do I understand that with the website we might be able to, because of the duality of the registrations, that we might eventually be able to register for an ID number for the state of Oregon for withholding purposes and go through that rather lengthy process as well? Can we avoid the long delays that we used to have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's one of the things I think that Jim Brown mentioned a little bit about, is that we want to have an online registration and return filing for business taxes, and make that as, we'll try to make our applications look as much now like the web or interactive like that as we go forward too, because people are becoming so used to using the internet and want to use that application. But there's really an untapped potential out there because people become more familiar and comfortable with technology. They can do it in 2 o'clock in the morning. They don't need to, you know, to schedule their time to match yours.
No. Absolutely agree with Senator Troll in that regard, and that is that the more information is available and the easier we make that information accessible to our constituents, the more compliant that they have the opportunity to be.
You bet. You bet. The other activity we've been engaged in quite actively is that there are a group of people who are intimidated, they're confused or whatever, really would like to have some in-person help. They would like to come in and sit down and talk with a person and work it through. They can't get it through brochures. They have a difficult time using a computer or whatever. They just want to find someone who cares and will sit down and talk with them. We've had a lot of activities lately. We've got down here Mall Days and Midnight Madness, and you may have seen those advertised in your local newspapers. A lot of times this is in conjunction with the Internal Revenue Service, that we will, close to the filing season, we will actually have staff available for you to bring in your tax information, and we'll help you work through it and give you information about how you should comply. We also have tax aid and volunteer income tax assistance training, and that's actually staffed by Department of Revenue employees on a volunteer basis. We pay for their training and support them through the training, and then they commit to actually volunteering their own time to go in on Saturdays or evenings to local community centers and help elderly and low-income and non-English-speaking people complete their tax returns. So,
get a sense of how many hours and how many of employees from the department are involved in that?
We can get that information for you, Chair Butler. It's pretty popular. People really enjoy that face-to-face contact. A lot of our revenue agents who do primarily phone contact, it's great to actually go out there and connect with the taxpayers and see the people who you're helping to serve. And I think it gives them a better sense, too, of the frustration people have. And it's also good training for them as they bring it back to their workplace, because they learn a little bit more about auditing or accounting than they may have had when they came into it as a collector or something.
Appreciate that information.
Yeah.
Let's commend you for doing it. That's tremendous. Commend those people who give up for themselves to do that.
Thank you. It's very rewarding for them as well. They come back very supportive of the tax system and just really enthused about helping people with a lot of new ideas, too, because we hear from taxpayers about, well, why don't you try this, or have you thought about that? So it gives us some kind of one-on-one interaction with people, and also breaks down a lot of those barriers that I think that we hear too often about, you know, taxing agencies is kind of intimidating and frightening. And when you actually sit down and see somebody with a resident agent, you know, they just look like you and me. So it helps that kind of interaction, too, as well.
And I have to ask this because I'm from the outreaches in rural Oregon. In rural Oregon, I know that the AARP and others have those kinds of programs. Where are they trained, and what screening do we do to assist for quality assurance and security issues in that regard? Can you help me with that?
Chair, but well, actually AARP is one of the driving forces behind volunteer income tax assistance and tax aid, and our staff actually supports and assists them. The IRS brings in staff to train on the federal law changes in the federal system, and the Department of Revenue brings our staff in to train the volunteers on the state taxes and state changes. So the level of training is very, very important to provide that quality of information. We also really stress to the volunteers to not get in too deep. You know, these people are not certified public accountants. They're volunteers. You may be working in mail openings. You may be a property tax assessor. You've got, 16 hours of training. You've got a good grounding, but don't try taking on any complex multi-state corporations. This is a pretty basic tax assistance.
I can tell you that's a hard thing to do.
So this is basic assistance to people who don't have apps because of their income, because of their speech, verbal speech, or because of their age. It just needs a little bit extra help for the long term. One of the things we've done, fairly recent activity, is been problem resolution meeting with the IRS, and that's really targeted at we've been really working with filing enforcement, trying to bring people, identify areas where we do have issues with non-compliance, and try to encourage people who have been afraid that they haven't filed, they haven't paid, they've gotten so far behind, they're intimidated about coming forward. We try to provide an avenue where we meet in the community with the IRS and say, come on down, bring all your information, we'll try to help you come into compliance. So that's been pretty successful, actually, in bringing some people into the system that have been basically trying to lie low because they got so far behind they didn't know what to do. We also provide technical training for tax practitioners, and then also, John touched upon that a little bit, we provide training for new businesses and employers. We have so many small businesses in Oregon that they really do need assistance on how to file and how to comply with our tax laws. I think Jim and Elizabeth touched a little bit about our voice response system and our phone line. We did get 300,000 calls in 1998 to answer by our tax help representative. We also have an interactive menu where you actually can push the buttons and actually hear messages depending on what your level of interest is. And several retirees are also using that to get information to keep up to date. And that's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So that's been very popular as well.
Sure. Is it fairly easy to get a live voice from somebody who can give individual attention to you other than a menu of numbers to push?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, it depends on the time of year. Last couple of months, it's been really very, very busy. We had basically into the tax season, and then we also had a lot of federal retirees trying to get access, and a lot of them wanted to speak to someone live. So it just depends. If you're later in the year, yes, you can probably get a live person. We did, I think...
Say to the federal retirees who haven't made applications.
Those that do not have a protected claiming?
Yeah. What do you say to them?
Well, actually, what we've told them is to make sure that they go ahead and file the form that we've sent them, and that we have keeping all of those, and as soon as the legislation that's passed has been Senate Bill 259, whenever that passes, we've actually got a lot of those run already, so we could actually send out the checks like within a week after the legislation passes, and you tell the department what date you want us to start issuing refunds. We tell people, there's nothing more you can really do, just hold tight and look at the website and try to keep informed.
The legislature passes the bill?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It all depends on Senate Bill 259 right now. It's pretty much all we've done all we can, and the retirees have done all they can, except contact you, which I think they're probably doing. So that's their avenue to try to move the legislation along.
What's the status of the dollar amount? Do you have a feel for that?
Mr. Chair, those returns that would have no protective claims, it depends on when you'd like to pay those out. If you, as Senate Bill 259 is now amended, it says the refunds will not be issued until July 1st of 1999. And that amount is $97 million, I believe. And obviously, the farther out that goes, the more these are accruing interest, so the more interest will accrue.
Those are the non-protected claims?
Those without protected claims, correct.
And that's July 1st of 99.
Right.
And that $97 million includes interest?
That's correct, Chair Butler.
So if Senate Bill 259 passes but does not allow interest, do you know the principal portion of that?
Mr. Chair, I believe by the agreement with the retirees, the state is required to, in order to meet the agreement, to pay interest. So if the legislature chose not to pay the interest, there could be a problem with the agreement that's been negotiated between the state and the retirees.
Talking about the unprotected claims.
Right, the non-protected claims. I believe that's the case.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the retirees filed a class action lawsuit and agreed to hold that part of the litigation that is related to those folks who have not got protected claims on file pending the enactment of Senate Bill 259, but the court-approved settlement did include some signature.
Okay, so that's the global case.
That's correct.
Thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chair, we'll just move along to page 39. And next two pages are basically some examples of the things that I mentioned this week to help our taxpayers. An example of our full year resident package for 40 essence, Form 40. You probably all seen this recently and had an opportunity to work with it. And then on pages 40, starting with pages 40, these are actually some screens from our website. So for those of you who haven't connected to the website, if you do, with your computer in your officer's home, this is what you would actually see. These are the screens you'd bring up. And on page 40, you can see the different options. We have federal retirees, tax information, the forms, publications, our rules. We also have job opportunities listed on there as well. Let's take you down. As we go through, for instance, on page 41, you can see the new information. If you were to click on the new information one, we'll bring you to this screen here. And you can see we have the billboard, which is our legislative newsletter, an explanation of how electronic funds transfer works, new and updated information on federal retirees, and then about the kicker. The kicker is obviously issue where taxpayers have a lot of interest in our questions. It's a very effective way of communicating with them about that and what the status of it is. Our communication staff works really hard to keep this updated daily sometimes, but at least weekly, so it's really fresh information. And then little tax tips. We give out little tax tips depending on what the month is, so people might be thinking about their tax plan. On page 42, it gives you into the form piece if you're in tax form. You can see the type of forms that you can actually download from the internet.
I noticed that you have 1994, 5, 6, and 7. Are those inclusive of the amended returns as well for those years?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that if someone discovered that they had in there, other than just, this isn't just a catch for someone who failed a file and is looking for the forms.
Right.
But it could also accommodate someone who discovered an error that was preparing current year tax return could go back and amend in 97.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the forms would include every form that we prepared and issued for that tax year.
Oh. Okay.
So it would be the 40, the 40F, the non-resident form, the partner resident form, the amended form, the corporate form.
Inspections and everything.
Everything that's related to the 1999 tax form for all programs would be available by clicking on the stuff.
Those are prepared basically in blank, and then you just download them onto a printer and then fill them out. At that point, you can't interactive screen fill them out then.
Mr. Chair, these, I believe you're correct. These are the downloadable. If you look at that screen, you'll see there's a little new, and it says fill-in forms, and I'm not fully conversant with exactly what fill-in forms we have available, but we are trying to, we're always looking for ways to help taxpayers use this process or this medium of communication. And there are a number of states that are providing fill-in forms, and see exploring that too.
Obviously, if you have the, once the Social Security number is entered in, the names are entered in, and they can insert the math or the numbers, then if the math could assist, then that would, and we're talking about master programming, but by the same token, the resources are certainly available to the department within the amount of effort that goes into your programming. You've actually become a mini tax service, and I think that's wonderful. We talked the other day about some TurboTax issues, and there's no reason for us to try and compete against TurboTax, but if the other services are out there and we can provide our own, and that service can be of greater benefit to the people and provide some retroactive tax years, we want to find, again, to encourage compliance in great measure.
Mr. Chair, I'll give a little more information about the filling form for you.
Senator Troll is recognized.
Just a question, I think, related not so much to the current topic right before us, the previous one. When Federal Congress did the survey of IRS and suggested some reforms for that agency, did that trigger thoughts that you might have in terms of anything that needs to be done here with our agency?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trump, actually, as a result of the IRS hearings, and we got a summary of the issues that were raised, the concerns that were raised, and what we did internally was a fairly in-depth review of how do we handle these circumstances, and here's how we handle them, and then take them to the management level and say, do we feel comfortable with this? Is this appropriate? And we also talked with the tax preparers and CPAs as well about how they felt about how we were interacting on certain areas. And we have made some modifications. One of the things the Department of Revenue takes great pride in is that we are not the IRS. I think there's a link sometimes in people's mind that you are, but we have, over the long period of time, tried to be more responsive, and because we are a part of the community, do a lot more to that community. But it was a really good time to step back and say, okay, how are we handling these types of issues? Are we comfortable with that?
How do you use the title?
Yes, I think it's always good to evaluate what you're doing and what you can do better.
This is already the kinder and gentler Department of Revenue.
Yes, right.
Sure. Representative Krupp, thank you. In regards to your great webpage here, in terms of tax forms, I couldn't get a Form 943 off of there in 98. Do you have that available now? Federal form.
Well, let's check. I'm not positive what form is on.
What's the state equivalent then? If it's not 943,
Q.
Yeah, it's the OQ. Good. Yeah. Okay.
We'll check on
Then I may be incorrect because it seemed that I seemed that there was one payroll related form from Oregon I could not get off of there that I needed at the time. But that was last year. Okay, that was mid year I think it was. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I did want to point out, Chair Butler, that as you go through here, too, we do have links directly on the website to TurboTax and the other preparers that can do electronic filing for orders. And that's one of the ways we've really been able to advertise and promote electronic filing. We don't endorse this, but those tax preparation software groups that are providing electronic filing, we would recognize them and say, if you would like to get more information, please click here. I can go directly to that. So that's been very helpful.
Great.
Okay, moving along to page 43. Just kind of confirm what we talked about with the website. You see the increase in the number of hits, or what we call hits, or basically access times into the website. And for 1999, we expect it to be up to 232,000. So as I said, it's very, very popular. It not only provides information, but it does allow people to download the forms and instructions for other states as well, so if you have to file for Idaho as well as Oregon or Washington, you can get there for...
Does other states?
Mm-hmm. Right, we have other states for instructions as well, as well as the federal information. Page 44, this one confirms how we see the society moving and the way people do want to file. Technology really is, as they always say, the wave of the future here. And you can see that, I think, as you look at this bar chart. That the little, the red is the traditional paper filers. The number of returns is indicated in red on here. The little green that you see starting to come in 1992 is electronic filing. So in 1992, we started out with only 1,300. And we're going way up right now, 1998, 99. And then the blue, I'll talk about the blue in a minute, it's what we call scan band, and that's kind of a technical term, I think. Most people have never heard of it. But the little pink one is the one we're really interested in. It's the PC modem. That's where you can actually file using TurboTax at home and file directly into the Department of Revenue. We see that's where people become more comfortable with their computers and internet and those kinds of actual interactions, but they'll be willing to do that more and go directly in. That would bypass the filing fee that they have to pay right now to do electronic filing. They can actually using that. So that's what we see where the area is moving.
Mr. Chair. Representative Krupp, is your opinion? Thank you. Pursuant to our conversations column that we had the other day in revenue, is part of the reason that people are more comfortable with, you think, in moving towards electronic filing is that they feel that there's security now in place in terms of their information not being intercepted or being able to have been. I know you've had some individuals been trying to hack into your system and so forth, and
it would seem to be that would be a major concern, I would think, for a lot of folks before using a situation like this.
Representative Krupp, I think that's part of it. The movement of the part of our success has been the movement of the IRS towards more electronic filing. People do that more, and they see that. They participate in that for a year or two, and it seems effective, and it works safer. They're more willing to do the state level, too, and do that piece. And we really do spend a lot of time and energy in making sure we have a secure system, and we do keep taxpayers' information very confidential, because that's kind of the keystone to a volunteering system, is making sure that we keep your information very confidential. But I think if you see people more comfortable with the Internet and providing the credit card numbers out there, buying things online, people, I think, are just, their level of comfort is moving from what it has been a few years back. You feel more safe, perhaps, that the systems are secure than they have been in the past. And I want to take just a couple minutes and talk about Scandam, because it's kind of an interesting idea. You see actually an example of that on page 45. And this is a very efficient way for us to gather data. But in if you have prepared your tax return using TurboTax or some other type of software package, either for yourself or for your tax preparer, after you enter your data, the preparers that have worked with the state of Oregon, they will actually print out your report, your form, looking very much like it always does. You did it yourself without using software. But at the top, they'll also encode some data. The block that you see at the top of page 45 is what we call a scan band. And this has two purposes for the state of Oregon. Actually, California pioneered this concept, but we picked up on it as well. Because it actually has the information in your form, but in a format that's much, much faster for the data entry people to do. It's all right here, so they can just see right off of this, and they don't have to flip through pages. So it's right here. And the second part of what it does is it also sets the stage for actually going to imaging and scanning technology down the road.
You don't use this for scanning purposes?
Not yet. The technology we've seen is not quite there, but it's used right for now for data entry, but it's very effective for data entry, and it's the next step we need to take to move into scanning.
California is all scan. It's all OCR scan. At this particular point, so they must have that equipment available.
Mr. Chair, we have actually visited California, been looking at the technology. That's one of the things we want to move into. The accuracy rate has not been really as high as it could be in the past, and we really do want to make sure. I think Nancy actually mentioned it perhaps during the tour that the processing center right now is so efficient that the technology has to be really efficient to outpace what we can do currently with our data entry people just keying at 18,000 strokes per whatever it is, hour. It's pretty amazing. So it has to actually, before we'll buy into it, it needs to be an improvement and show demonstrated productivity savings for it. Scanning isn't there yet. It's getting there. It'll be over time.
Can I ask a couple of questions with regard to the PC modem and the scan band. Relative to the PC modem, that rather substantial increase from 700 to 15,000 returns. Are we gearing up to be able to proactively prepare for that phenomenon at this time?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we are. That really is an issue. I think that's where people are going to be going.
Okay.
We have employees within our department have actually done that. We're quite thrilled with how easy it was to do. And I think that the software preparers have actually done a lot to make it easier for the public to use it. So we've worked really hard with the major tax preparer software to get it to that point.
And the reason I ask that, Susan, is I noticed that your department is geared heavily towards the paper. And as you move away from the paper, if you took the same percentage of increase from 97 to 98 to 98 to 99, most of that is going to move away from paper and it'll be scan band and paper, but I anticipate that it's gonna, and as long as you're prepared for it, I think that's great. Second question I had was relative to the scan band information. There's the ages are reflected there, and I'd like to know what we do with the information relative to age on a tax return.
Well, We'll have to get the answer to that one.
It was probably helpful back during the HARP days, and it might be helpful for issues dealing with the age 58 or 63 or whatever it is. Usually I'm not active in practice for the last year relative to the ABDAC on medical. But I guess I'm struggling with that just a little bit. And then finally, most states now ask for the school district in which you reside, your residence, is actually physically present. And as I see Oregon moving towards issues dealing with local option tax, perhaps, and other issues, I'm wondering if we shouldn't consider, as long as we're gathering data on tax returns, the school district in which the taxpayers actually physically reside may be very useful information for us to be able to develop data to assist us as a legislature to better get fiscal and revenue prepared for any other modifications to assist with the education funding issues that we're going to be grappling with, so we can try to be proactive in that regard. So make that suggestion.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Sure, we'll look into both of those issues.
Thank you.
And then moving to page 46, it just kind of confirms what we talked about, the growth of the electronic filing, and I think you heard about that during the tour. Actually, our projection for 1998, we're measuring about 153,000. So it's really taking off, too, in part as I mentioned, by the growth of electronic filing at the federal level. And we have a couple little graphs back here to explain why we're so excited about that and why we think it means quite a bit to the Oregon taxpayers. First of all, it's kind of one of the ways we're going to be able to keep up with increased workload we've talked about. But on page 47, this probably looks familiar to those of you who are interested to come on this tour with us. But it shows you basically the black line is all the different steps that you have to go through if you finish your paper return. And we can walk it all the way through from mail opening, sorting, reviewing, numbering, taxpayer identification, and then actually before it starts, the processing system is not until step 7. If you send an electronically filed return, it skips all that, you know, first 6 steps and goes right into this system. So there's a real substantial savings as far as the amount of workload that goes into it and the speed. Nancy talked with you about how the speed of that. And on page 48, we have the statistics that kind of give you an idea of the cost to process the return. If it's paper, it's $1.89. If it's electronically filed, it's $1.47. So there's quite a substantial savings by doing electronic filing. And the real benefit to the taxpayers, and I think this is partly in response to Representative Krupp's question too, is that they can get their refunds so much faster. 9 days versus 32.
Pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It
really is. Maybe it's worth that little bit of concern about security or risk or whatever to get your money in your hand almost 3 weeks earlier.
Yeah. I had a question relative to step 9.
Sure.
Step 9, if we considered the possibility of bank debits as opposed to actually cutting the refund checks. I know that you can do thousands per hour of the refund checks, but obviously all of that information has already gone through the computers. And I'm wondering about the possibility of just doing that refund check on those returns that we've had no problems on. If people are waiting for their refund checks, to just go straight to a bank debit system.
Mr. Chair, we can get you more information on that. We've looked at it some extent. Again, it comes down to a matter of cost. It is very cost-effective to actually cut the checks and mail them out. The processing is the debiting to the taxpayer's account. It's a little more involved. It's a little bit more expensive. We'll get you some more information on that, too. Okay, with that, if there are any more questions, I'd like to turn it over to John again. He's going to talk about how the information technology has impacted the business world. 49.
just continuing the theme, trying to make things easier for taxpayers, not only individual taxpayers, but also businesses. In 1998, we implemented an electronic tax payments for businesses. And we started out with businesses that had at least $1 million annual liability, and then also those who volunteered. As you can see from the graph at the top, talks about the number of dollars that are collected, and the graph at the bottom is the number of businesses that are participating. I wanted to maybe draw your attention to the first spike there, and that's around October, November. And what that really represents is that it's the third quarter payment that's due October 31st that we received November the 1st. And that's the reason why there's a huge spike there, because it captures, if you recall, I talked about the payroll taxes and the combined taxes before. That's where businesses are then paying the unemployment, the workers' comp, and they're paying all that at one time. On an ongoing basis, businesses pay their monthly or weekly their payroll directly to us, so that's why we'll have spikes at that period, as well as at the end of the fourth quarter, which is January 31st that we receive on February 1st, and that's the reason why those spikes are those 2 years.
And then if you look at the lower graph, you'll see that we haven't even reached 9,000 employers, and as John told you, we have 100,000 employers in our system, so we still have a number more to bring into the program.
And our plan is to phase this in over the next 2 years. July of this year, we'll move far down for those businesses that have liabilities of $200,000 or more, and then July of next year, $50,000, and then July of 2001, anyone required to pay electronically for federal. We will bring the corporate excise tax online July of this year, and again, we'll start with the major, and then we'll work down to anyone who required to pay electronically for the federal.
Thank you. John, what's in July 1st of 2001, what's going to be the threshold that requires on the federal level for employers to file electronically and under payroll taxes?
On July 1st, the $50,000?
No, July 1st, 2001, where it says anyone required. What is that threshold level at that point?
I'm not sure.
Representative, as I recall, we need to get comfortable information for you on this, but the federal government has really changed their guidelines on this. So at one point, they were talking about taking it lower than $50,000. As it stands now, I believe they're going to probably stop at $50,000. So the 2000-2001 may stay the same. But by phasing it in, we wanted to parallel and piggyback with the federal. And the federal has changed their numbers as they've had some experience. So we want to take a less aggressive approach than the federal government and basically learn from where they're stopping.
So Mr. Chair, you anticipate then continuing to stay parallel with the federal government, and
right,
whatever changes they make, you
right,
will mirror the changes of your activity. Okay.
And Mr. Chair, if they do slow down, if they for some reason slow down from the 200,000 to 50,000, we would consider that as well, because we don't want to require electronic tax payments for the state. We still have to do it for the federal. Because the way it works now, it's very easy for the employers to do it if they're doing it already. Unless you're a volunteer. Some businesses really like this technology and want to do this. They find it a cost savings for them. So they volunteer to do it even if they don't have to do it for federal.
It's actually one of the issues we're looking at on the farms is to voluntarily do that, because it does save us some time and so forth. So
historically,
the federal has given dates and projections and then slowed them down somewhat because of the burdens that it creates on small private enterprise.
Okay. I think, unless there are other questions, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back to Susan and we'll talk about our enforcement. efforts in the pushing that.
Mr. Chair, Elizabeth, when she began the section, talked about the balanced approach to healthy income taxes. We've been primarily talking about supporting food assistance and education those who wish to voluntarily comply and file the claim. And unfortunately, there will probably always be those who do not wish to file and pay. So for those individuals who have enforcement activities, this is what this table is basically talking about, is our enforcement efforts as we work with people who have chosen not to. In some cases, they just put it off, they procrastinated and haven't filed and haven't paid. In other cases, a very small portion, thank heaven, they are actually trying to evade taxes. We give you here from 95-97 and 97-99 biennium our estimates of the returns that we've audited. We do get information from the federal government. We get a case of their federal income tax information. We match that with our own master file database, and then we use that information to select our audit case. That's the method we follow. But the federal income tax system is very, very important to Oregon because we are so highly reliant on the personal income tax program in Oregon, and it is such a close match with the federal. The permanent reconnect, the rolling reconnect that was put into place in 97, the legislature just confirms that, but we want to keep the two as parallel as possible. And most of our audits are relating to adjustments for federal income. Probably about 80 to 90% of the adjustments are made to federal income.
It's all shared information, Susan.
Right, that's based on the shared information we receive from the IRS.
We have that same shared information arrangement with all 49 other states or the balance of the taxing states?
No, we don't on a formal arrangement, Chair Butler. We do. The other 10 to 20% of our adjustments that we make to Oregon modifications and credits, a lot of those are related to Oregon source income, looking at how income is apportioned among the different states and trying to resolve that. So taxpayers pay at least 100%, but no more than 100%. So we do, through the corporate income tax program, and John talks about that a little bit more, there is a multi-state tax commission that has more of a formal arrangement that they share information on major corporations that operate across state lines and across the nation. But on an individual basis, it's more informal. The Federation of Tax Administrators is composed of all the states, and they work, have conferences and workshops to try to bring the states as much as possible in uniformity and with each other. But it is a major issue.
We share information based upon our non-compliant staff with internal evidence.
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair. We work cooperatively with them, especially as it relates to the more difficult non-filers. The IRS really does take the lead in criminal cases. So if they're working with an Oregon non-filer, which develops into a criminal case, we will support and assist them and they will actually take it through the process. But we don't have the resources to pursue criminal action.
Do you roll your liability into their levy and lien?
No, Mr. Chair, we actually have separate processes, but we attempt to reconcile the two so the taxpayer is not torn somehow with the state and the federal trying to get to both the same pie, basically. So we work with the IRS and meet with them regularly to try to cooperate on individual taxpayers as well. So we have an arrangement on that.
You've got a separate department that wouldn't affect a lot of, wouldn't have a large number of employees involved with that, but it's that's a fairly aggressive day-to-day managed department. How many staff do we have doing that?
Actually, Mr. Chair, we have some statistics down here on this on the chart on page 58 that actually show our non-filer program. We have, I need to get to the numbers of employees that are actually involved in that, but these are the employees that are working with those taxpayers we call procrastinators, people who just have meetings that to file and need to pay, but they just, one thing came up, maybe it was something personal in life, divorce or illness or, you know, bankruptcy or business issues. So once they get behind a year, it's hard to get back into the system. It gets a little scary, and sometimes we catch people that are out 4 or 5 years, and we're able to work with them because there's not any intent to not pay. It's just it kind of got away from them. So those people we deal with, and we get returns from them voluntarily many times. The other group is much more, as you say, labor-intensive, and it's really a lot of work to get from some of these people because they are now using a legal system and going to court and filing liens against individuals. They're very, very sophisticated committee. So that's a very labor-intensive, but it's a very important activity because they can bring other people into their schemes and convince other people that there's some kind of miracle that you do if you get away with not part of the class because you're clever enough and smart enough. And they ruin other people's lives and also that they're in the most major tax difficulties. Plus, I think most taxpayers feel you may not like paying your taxes, but you realize it's your obligation, and you feel that everybody else has to do it, you can do it. When you see people that are actually getting away with not paying it and actually flouting it, it really undermines the system. So it's important, even if they're very difficult, to keep after those individuals and keep them complying and participating as much as we can. It's difficult. So here the information we presented here is the returns we audited. Our total audit billings is this year's about, this biennium is about $131 million, we anticipate. About 18,000 returns filed due to our non-filer program. And then we expect to collect about $69 million from the non-filer program. And the amount of outstanding liabilities, whether this is something people have admitted they owe, that self-assessed, I know I owe this amount of money and I'll pay you at some point. Or we have issued an assessment because the taxpayer hasn't come forward and filed given us information. We've assessed it against them, about $261 million. And then the total liabilities collected that we actually have collected is about $171 million. So this is the other half of the balanced approach, you say. You know, it's very important to keep people in the system and help them and support them through their compliance efforts. But if they start slipping out, we need to help bring them back in. Or if they're consciously trying to evade it, we need to work with them and get them back into the system, whether voluntarily or involuntarily.
Again, the amounts that we're dealing with, as the dollars balance and liabilities collected, do not include any of the Wayne County Transit Authority or the Commonwealth. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. This is simply income tax. These are not any of our contract programs that we operate and participate in. So that's the information on the personal income tax side. And John from the business division has the other part of that, the corporate excise tax. I'm afraid to talk to you about that on page 50B.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I thought I would take a moment to just simply give a kind of brief outline of the corporate excise tax. And it consists of Oregon companies, Oregon corporations paying 6.6% of the Oregon taxable income. We start with the federal. This excise tax is actually a privilege tax. It's a doing business tax. The tax is based on the income of the corporation. Vast majority of the money in terms of our enforcement really come in just like they do on the personal income tax side voluntarily. Some of the corporations in terms of our audits, some of our auditors, you might know, and let me just draw your attention to that, as we compare 95, 97 to 97-99 estimates. And in 95-97, we conducted 57-28 audits, and in 97-99, we anticipate completing 36 corporate audits, or 3,600, excuse me. Some of our corporate auditors were temporarily assigned. This is Jim Brown mentioned earlier. We have a number of programs that need to be upgraded, some technology enhancements, as well as bring a number of those programs into Y2K compliance. So we temporarily assigned some of the auditors who had that technical skill to those kinds of duties to make sure that we're up to speed now and in the future. And then as we complete that, then we'll then go back to looking at auditing some of the other smaller corporations. What we try to focus on now is focus on our share of income that's attributable to Oregon. And in terms of, if you look at a large pie, and there are like 50 states, and multiple multi-state corporations are doing businesses in all of that state, then what part of that pie is then attributable to Oregon? And that's what we try to do. We don't want more or less than what is appropriate. That's what we try to do. We have focused on some of the larger corporations, and our auditors look at issues that come up periodically that are non-compliance issues, I thought those are the areas where they're trying to focus on. In the corporations that are home-based here in Oregon, who have a larger presence, we look at beyond just simply the attributable to Oregon. We look at also the payroll properties and sales because they have a larger presence and there's a large percentage of that profit that is attributable to Oregon.
Sure. Do we have a way of knowing to those corporations that are going to benefit from our kicker rebate, knowing that they are corporations in good standing before they benefit from the rebate? In other words, they are people who don't owe us money, but...
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Schroll, the way the kicker is handled for corporations is a credit rather than a check. And so those corporations that file, let me just give you an example. We had a kicker that was determined to be due at the end of 1997. Well, that showed up as a credit then for corporations that were going to file returns and have tax due for the 1997 tax year in 1998. Many of those companies, if they knew they were going to have a kicker coming, could reduce their estimated payments so that they wouldn't have a large refund coming. But if their cash that's going to leave, or a refund check that's going to leave the department, we always verify that whoever it is we're sending that check out to doesn't owe the state money that we're aware of. If they do, then it comes out of that check. That's what you meant by in good standing. Some other places.
Would that work also in the credit then? If they owe you money, that comes out of the credit because you would give them a what do you call that?
Credit fund.
It won't reduce the credit that's available to them.
Right.
But if they actually have a refund coming, if they have overpaid their estimated tax, and then when they file the return, the annual return that actually determines this is how much tax they owe, and then they look back at the quarterly estimated payments that they've made that preceded the filing of that return. If they've overpaid and are going to be entitled to some money back, and if we would be sending them a check, then we can verify that there isn't some other money owing that we would offset against the amount of that check. But if they have estimated their liability accurately, and there's no check that we would need to issue, or they've maybe got a small amount to pay, then we don't have the ability to do anything that would be an offset out of the credit that goes into the calculation of their tax due.
Other questions? Mr. Chairman, when someone doesn't pay that their taxes in time, you charge interest by the time they can get the amount. 12% often, what's the percentage of it?
Senator Lim, I believe the interest rate right now is 9%.
9%, okay. My question is, when someone have an extra amount of money sitting in your department, maybe if it's a small amount, that can be 10,000 or more, but you don't pay interest for them, though. The money sitting in their account.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, under the current law, we're directed to pay interest on refund checks only beginning June 1st after the due date of tax returns. So there is a period of time if someone has made too much in their advance payments, whether they've had too much withheld from their check or they've made too great an amount of estimated payments, and they send their return in and we refund the difference before June 1st, then you're correct, they don't get interest on that, according to state law.
One more question. Maybe these staff might have it directly related. Could you give us an explanation of what the European unitary tax and how does it work? Could you give me 2 minutes to just give me some updates for that?
The unitary tax is actually a method of determining how much income of a company that's doing business in many states or in many countries should pay in oil. We start with what we call the unitary business, which is the business enterprise where all the parts of it are interrelated in earning income. And we start out with their federal return. Usually a family of companies that's all under common ownership will file what's called a consolidated federal return. So we begin with that and make sure that all those companies are working together, that there's not somebody that's got one company that's got a completely separate business. We would move that out. All the related companies, then whatever their net profit is, their net income, we have to figure out, as John said, how much of the pie of all of their income can be fairly assigned to the activities they have in Oregon. And so we use a formula, and the formula takes into account their payroll in the state as compared to their payroll everywhere, their sales in the state as compared to their sales everywhere, and their property in the state as compared to everywhere. And those things are added together and divided, and then they come up with a percentage, and we apply the percentage to the income. In the 1970s and the very early 1980s, the pie that we looked at was the whole business enterprise without regard to political or geographic boundaries. So if the company was a multinational corporation or family of corporations, and they were doing business in the Pacific Rim and in the United States and in Europe, but it was an integrated enterprise, all of which was earning income by cooperating together, we would look at that whole pie. And then in that apportionment formula, the comparison of their in-state activity to their out-of-state would be everywhere in the world would be in the denominator of those two factors, and then and so the percentage would be a lot smaller. During the 1984 special legislative session, the legislature said we want to move away from looking at the whole world of operations and only look at what's going on inside the United States. And so we made that change, and that's why we now start with their federal tax return, because that is limited geographically to what they're doing in the United States.
That's what you call within the unitary tax.
That's correct.
Okay, so we are looking at only the United States, not other countries.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Kenya did a good job explaining that. I was here in 84. I was here in 84. I'm still confused. I voted for it.
The only other thing I wanted to maybe highlight is the fact that with the corporations that are home-based here in Oregon, we work with them on an ongoing basis, provide technical assistance. A number of times they call our corporate office, the corporation's audit office, and ask for advice and counsel prior to filing or making a decision which way to go, so they make sure that they do it right. Because our end is, in fact, that they pay the right tax, and that we pull all of our efforts into education and assistance so that corporations voluntarily comply. And that's what we're all about.
I have a question with regard to the name of the Chicago office.
Yes.
Is that primarily dealing with the corporate activities nationwide, or is that for some other reason?
Primarily the corporate activities that are Midwest and on the Eastern Seaboard. There are a number of corporations that are home-based in Chicago, Midwest, and Eastern Seaboard, and we have three auditors that spend all of their time auditing those companies. And just kind of for your information, at one time we did have an office in New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. When we look at return on investment, for every dollar that we invest into the audit program, be it Chicago or the multi-state, it generally returns to us at least $10.
Interesting. How many employees do you have in Chicago?
Three.
Are they Oregon employees?
They are Oregon employees.
And pay Illinois state tax? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
The ratio of the audit billings 95-97 as compared to 97-99 went from $8,100 to over $13,000. Was there some specific reason that that happened? That's per unit.
I asked that question as well. And some of it has to do with a couple of large buildings, large collections. And there's no particular point at which we can anticipate this will be a $5 million issue, or this will be a $1 million issue, or this will be a refund. And that's just the case here.
This is where you caught up with the Lehman Enterprises International.
Mr. Chair?
President Krupp, Chair.
Why the drop in audits from 95, 97, 97, 89?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, as I indicated earlier, we conducted less audits because we temporarily shifted the audit staff, some of the auditors, to work on some of the technology issues and technology upgrades so that we could be compliant and ready to deal with the issues that we need to deal with today and tomorrow. They will be returning.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up very briefly on that. The staff at the Department of Revenue is very highly skilled, and for us to be able to take full advantage of that, we look for ways to use people's skills where we need it. And the technology, what we call our migration project, is one that I'm personally very proud of the employees who have worked on that. It takes information systems professionals, but it also takes people who are going to use the system to help design it well so that it can be very productive. And so we have taken some of our audit staff, corporation auditors, as well as auditors that work in the personal income tax area, and said, you're the ones who are most knowledgeable about what you need the system to be able to do for you. And so we need you to help us from the user side so that as that program is being written, the information systems professionals know what it is that we need so that the system will provide the productivity gains that we're expecting from it. And our staff has very willingly moved from work they love to other work that they found is also very interesting and exciting, and have really just done a wonderful job for us in helping us really make some of those gains with our information systems and auditor systems that we've developed. And corporate auditors particularly have worked on the corporation automated system that we brought up within the last 2 years, and really it's as good as it is because of the work that the staff put into it.
I had one other question relative to the corporates themselves, or the, I guess, audit offices. How many foreign corporations, that's non-Oregon corporations, have offices in Oregon from other states?
Depending on the work.
Mr. Chair, I'm not understanding the question. How many businesses have offices here, or how many other states?
Taxing departments.
No.
There are none other.
None that I'm aware.
Okay.
There's really small fish.
Right.
Okay. But the three Chicago office people are all Oregonians that are paying Illinois tax and taking the credits necessary. They're not. They're Illinois residents and Illinois taxpayers and pay no Oregon tax.
Well,
Chair, you argue that the office is very cost effective, and it really makes sense to have it there.
Yes. As a matter of fact, Oregon has probably one of the smaller offices in the out-of-state audit programs compared to other states. And just to give you a sense of that, the state of California has more than 50 staff alone in Chicago.
Is that, and I'm not going to, I'm not this isn't meant to be critical, but we don't incur a great deal of extra travel expenses, because I know there is at least one State Department that has, or one department in the state organization, spends a huge amount of their resources traveling to audit returns of a different nature. We don't spend a great deal of money on the road traveling, I assume, to audit books and records of these foreign corporations. When I say foreign corporations, non-Oregon corporations.
Mr. Chair, that's one of the reasons we have an office in Chicago, right, is that our auditors, to audit a large corporation, you must go to their,
right,
their headquarters. And so by having employees who are based in Chicago who can then work with the companies that are headquartered in that area, that keeps that travel cost down. We do have employees who work in our Portland office who do fly to whether it's Los Angeles or Denver or San Francisco or wherever they need to in the western United States to go to corporate headquarters. But when John talks about the cost effectiveness of our corporate audit program, that is including and taking into account the cost of travel.
We're on page 50B, going into 50C, is this a good place to close it down here, John, and Ms. Archenko?
Yes, we can pick up with our performance measures first thing tomorrow and talk about the compliance check. It'd be nice if we could just take 30 seconds to do the page that comes after 50B. And that would be a nice closing point for us, if that's okay.
If it will save you a staff person from having to come over tomorrow,
that's okay. It's just a nice break.
I have a few questions.
Yes. We just wanted to bring this up, and something we're very proud of within the department, and actually this is a product of the result of our review of our operations from the IRS hearings that Senator Trow asked us about. As we talked about a balanced approach to income tax system, two things are really important: that we resolve the issue with the taxpayer, and then we do it in such a way that it's respectful to the taxpayer. So as a result of that, and if you look back on when we talked about on page 36 that we get about basically 90% of the money involuntarily, we really need to encourage and support people and work through that. And what we did was we sat down with a group of employees and asked them to really look at what do they think are the best practices. If they look around them as their coworkers or perhaps themselves, what kind of attributes and what kind of things that they do are really rewarded, not only monetarily, but by these nice letters from the taxpayers or the calls and those types of things. And it's interesting that those two seem to go hand in hand. Some of our best collection people also receive the most compliments and the most praise from the taxpayers. So it's not necessary to be the big, tough, nasty agency. By treating people respectfully and working with them, we do get very good results. And that's what this has conveyed, is that we talked about what are we really here for? And our business is compliant, and we have the statement, we achieve our business through enforcement, education, and providing excellent services to the taxpayers. We restated our organizational values, and then our guiding principle. And this is something I've actually, you see posted on people's little cubicles, and they've got this stuff over in the agency, which is really proud of. And it doesn't just sit on the shelf like some of these grandiose statements. But this is something, because the employees develop themselves, I think they have a lot of ownership in this and feel strongly about it. The guiding principle to work with people in a courteous and respectful manner to help them understand the voluntary comply with Oregon tax laws. And then we've actually stated down here the personal qualities and best practices that our most successful employees have. And these were brought forward by the employees as they looked at their coworkers. And I certainly echo and support all of these. I think these are very valuable attributes, not only for Department of Revenue employees, but for all employees.
They're absolutely excellent. We'll visit perhaps and we'll look more about it tomorrow. But I just as I went through those, I just wondered, do you feel like that you have 100% buy-in, or pretty close to 100% buy-in from the staff, from the rather substantial staff that you have, to these guiding principles?
Mr. Chair, I do. Actually, this document was a product of the work of both the business division and the personal tax and compliance division, as they talked about how they work with taxpayers.
It starts off with honesty is the best policy, and it goes on to the golden rule, and it just gets better from there. I think it's great. I think you do. And if you've got 100% buy-in, then chances are we've got the best department in the state sitting here with us today.
Thank you very much.
Are there other questions before we
I was wondering, it's kind of a comment, but I wonder if since we're tied to a closely to the federal tax code, that we don't benefit from some of the IRS investigation of people who violate at the federal level must be instructive to you in terms of the state.
That's very much appreciated. Share information with us. We've really worked hard to develop a relationship where we can share information and gain from the investigations and the criminal activities that they're investigating. Because as I mentioned, those are very, very costly and labor intensive, and we can't really launch those on our own.
Thank you very much. If there's no further business, we'll take back up at 1 o'clock tomorrow. Thank you very much.